Lee, reel number one. Now, what sort of work were you doing at the beginning of the war?
Well, I had just left school. I went and took the matric, London, at the City and Guilds, matric, and subsequently went as a pupil to Vickers down at Erith.
What kind of training did you get at Vickers? Was it a training that had any usefulness as far as your later service with the RNAS was concerned?
No, I shouldn't think it was like that. It was a training in turning and drilling and sort of crafts you get from being in a works, but I shouldn't think it had any particular value in subsequent value like that for the RNS.
Yes. What were your reactions to the outbreak of war? What did you do to try and get into any of the services?
Well, I hadn't started because I had just gone to Vickers and I was very young. I, of course, I was looking around and wondering when I could get in. I don't think they would have taken me for the army until I'd been about 18 anyway. And I met a friend of my father's, really, who was one of the assistant accountant generals of the Admiralty. And, of course, came to know me to a certain extent. And heard that I was interested in getting into the flying. I was thinking of the RFC. And he asked me if I'd like to apply for a commission in the RNAS. Of course, I said I would very much. I can't remember the exact procedure after that, but I know I got an appointment. I got an interview at the Admiralty, and I was passed on the interview, and passed a medical, and the next thing that I knew was I got a permanent commission in the RNAS as a probationary flight sub-lieutenant.
Did you have any difficulty in getting a release from Vickers so you could join up?
No, they weren't too keen about it at all. No, not at all. They didn't like it. And as far as I know, they wrote to the RFC, the Army, and tried to stop it, but of course they'd run to the wrong place. I never heard any more about it. But no, they weren't. They were cross about it.
Now, after you joined the Naval Air Service, you started off doing your flying training at Hendon, where you joined the Graham White School, which was a civilian school, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
What was the scale of operations at the school?
Well, they had, as far as I can remember now, they had about three, I think, box kites, Graham White box kites, for the training part of it. And there were, I think, two instructors. The senior one was a man named Winter, and the other one was really a little Russian. Sometimes he called himself Russell, and other times he called himself Osipenko. But he was, they were both of them jolly good-hearted chaps and taught us how to fly.
Which of them was your instructor?
Well, chiefly, I think I had Osipenko.
Yes.
You might have either one or the other, but Osipenko, I think, was the chief one.
What kind of chap was he? Do you remember him very clearly?
Yes, I remember him very clearly. He was Russian, his English was very limited, and he had some very strong views as to what you... He was a very brave little fellow. He sat behind you in this box kite and leant over your shoulder and caught hold of the joystick over your hand, so to speak, but he had no control on the rudder bar, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to say, left, right, left, right, left, right, left, 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 quick when I tell you. You not do it quickly, you come down and kill your bloody self.
This was referring to the sort of movements you were making on
the
rudder bar.
Yes,
yeah. You're giving it too much right foot.
Oh, yes, they do. Well, I mean, one was learning and you didn't realise how much movement, how very little movement is required.
Yes. Now, the box kites, did you find that they were really suitable for flying training?
Oh, I think so. Of course, one hadn't any knowledge of anything else at that stage. And, of course, subsequently, I mean, the training became very much more sophisticated.
But the box kites weren't really equipped for proper dual control, were they?
No, no, no. There was no dual control on them at all.
Yes.
And there were no instruments on them either, with the exception of a very crude form of airspeed indicator, which really consisted of a rod with a metal cup at the end of it, and which was sort of geared to a pointer, which indicated, roughly speaking, according to the pressure of the air, whether you were doing 30 miles an hour or 40 or 50 or whatever it was. And that was right out on one of the wings. So, I mean, you couldn't be watching that and watching what you were doing, so to speak.
Yes.
So virtually there was no airspeed indicator.
Yes. Now, how did
I learned to fly by feel.
Yes. How did they organise the training at Hendon? How were you first introduced to the aircraft and how was the training developed?
Well, I should say there was very little organisation about it. Extremely little organisation. I think we were taken up, as far as I can remember, we were taken up for a few minutes, sort of flown round just to sort of feel what it's like, and then you got into the flying seat and the instructor sat on this outrigger behind you with his legs dangling on each side. And I should think, hoping for the best. I think they were extremely brave chaps. Mm. But we had very few... In fact, I don't think we had any accidents while I was there that I knew I could think of. Mm. We had a lot of engine failures, of course. That was a normal thing.
And once you'd started on your flying training, what were the first sort of exercises which you had to carry out?
Oh, I did straights for a start.
What did that involve?
It was simply flying straight across the aerodrome and then turning around, flying straight back again. You do quite a few of those.
Would you land? And
yes, land, you see, and then turn around on the ground, then crack off back.
Take off and land
take
again.
Take off and land the other side again.
Yes.
You had straights, you see. And
so you'd actually do the turn on the ground?
You do the turn on the ground.
Yes.
And then after that, you'll start flying around, going up a bit and turning.
Yeah. Did that present any difficulties for you?
No, I don't think so. I think my total flying time, as far as I can now remember, up to the time I got my ticket, was about 5 hours, 40 minutes, and I think I was a bit slow. Some of them did it less than that.
Now, how long was it before you qualified as a pilot?
Well, as far as I can remember, it was about 5 hours, 40 minutes altogether.
And how long had it taken you to get that much flying time? How many weeks had you been at Hendon to get that much flying in?
Well, it's a long time ago, and I can't say for certain, but yeah. I should think it was roughly, it would have been about 6 weeks.
Yes.
Because, you see, the great thing was you only flew if the weather was, there was virtually no wind, early morning and in evening. There had to be virtually no wind. And consequently, you had quite a lot of days when you didn't fly at all.
Yes. And if you were only flying in the morning and the evening, how did you fill in the gap in the middle during the day?
Well, that I can't remember.
The test itself, then, took place after you'd been about there 5 or 6 weeks. Did you
when they thought you were reasonably... You, as far as I can remember, you had to do figures of eight. You had, I think it was five figures of eight on a right-hand turn and five on the left, I think, as far as I can remember. Mm. And then you had to do a land to the mark. You had to land within so many yards of a mark, in other words, some man standing out in the middle, more or less the middle of the airdrop. And then you also did, and then you finished off with switching off your engine, and it had to be from over 500 feet. And in order to make certain you got to 500 feet, you had a large box, I think about, oh, I think it would have been about 7 or 8 inches square, slung round your neck by a bit of string, and also around your body. And this is an aneroid barometer. And this registered your 500 feet, you were all right.
Yeah.
And then you just came down. And
why did you call it a barometer? Why not an altimeter?
Well, they don't think you'd got any altimeters in those days. This was an aneroid, you know, like a pressure thing when he's revolving a paper disc thing, you know, with a thing on.
Are there any particular flights at Hendon which stand out in your mind?
Yes. I think it was the thing which really outstanding in my mind was about the very first time I ever took a passenger, which was about 2 minutes after I'd done my VP, which was the final act in my ticket. I landed the box kite rather on the far side of the aerodrome, and they had two little wheels on a small axle, both of them tied onto skids on the aircraft by rubber sandow, as we called it. And it was very easy, unless you landed absolutely dead straight, to tip one of these two little wheels over. And that's what I did when I landed on the VP.
Tip one of the skids over?
No, one of the wheels. The two wheels turn over on the skid.
Uh-huh.
And in due course, a mechanic arrived out, having walked across the aerodrome, and he hoisted the old aeroplane up on one side and got the wheels straight again, and then he started up the engine, and then he said, "Give me a lift back." I said, "All right." And he stood on the skid one side and held on to the frame that rudder bar and the rest of it's rigged on. And so I was taxiing back. He said, "Oh, let her go." I said, "Well, you hold on tight." So with that, I took him up. And I took him up in the straight. I think we went up probably about 20 feet or something like that. And I landed at the other side of the air, back home again. He was a very brave and chap. Didn't bore at all.
Now, during this period at Hendon, did you feel as if you were part of the service, despite the fact that you were flying at a civilian flying school?
Oh, yes. We lived in a house, or two or three houses, up fairly near the gates. I can't remember the name of the road, near the gates of Hendon. And we had our mess, where we fed, had lunch and dinner and so on. Oh, yes, we're very, very much in the service, all right.
Now, after you left Hendon, you went on to Chingford. How did the setup at the Royal Naval Air Service Station at Chingford compare with that which you'd experienced at Hendon?
Well, of course, Chingford was more of an air station. In fact, it was a proper air station than Hendon. And one went there with the idea of learning to fly war machines. First thing I flew when I got there was a box kite, I think a Bristol box kite this time, but the same thing as the grey and white, really. I just flew that to show that I really could do it.
Mm.
And then I went on to a Morris Farman.
Yes.
The chief instructor there was a man named Merriam, who was a very fine little flyer, but of course he'd got a tremendous lot to try and cope with, and they had got a certain number of the more senior, more promising pupils, so to speak, who were acting as instructors.
What was the nature of the instruction you received? Now, how was the training you received at Chingford organized? In what way was your flying competence developed there?
Well, you went on sort of progressively onto more difficult machines. That was the sort of principle of it, I think. As I say, I started off on the box kite, and then I went on to a Morris Farman, and then I went on to an Avro, 50 Avro, which was the sort of first tractor that I'd ever flown.
How did the flying characteristics of that airplane compare with the old box kites which you'd experienced? You must have noticed some dramatic differences.
Oh, well, they're all, of course, they'd all got these, all these aircraft had got instruments on. They'd all got airspeed indicators and rev counters and the rest of them, which the box kites hadn't. Oh, yes, and of course, a tractor is different to a pusher.
In what ways?
Well, you haven't, you can't see out of the front in the same way that you can out of a pusher. You with a box kite. And of course, it makes a bit of a difference for landing and getting off. And then after a time there, I can't remember how long I was there. I wasn't there very long before I was posted to Calshot, the seaplanes.
Yes. Was there any operational flying done at Chingford?
Well, there was one or two aircraft were kept for operational flying. If necessary, but there was only one. Just hold on.